You're listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and Friends, the number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism, broadcasting live from Florida's Sun Coast on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Don't forget, you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's the travel guy, Roy Lowy.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. This is Roy Lowy, and on behalf of our team of technicians and journalists, I want to thank our listeners for voting us your favorite radio talk show for in-depth travel journalism once again. In 2006, you have our pledge to continue bringing you the best overall on-air and web coverage this industry has to offer. I kind of apologize. I'm kind of losing my voice a little bit here this morning, finding a bit of a cold. Our guests today are Mr. Evan Eggers, president of O2Cruise.com, your cruise supermarket, and Julie Wardell, media manager for the Orlando and Orange County CVB, will be with us. Mr. Antonio Graceffo, author of 4 Years of Living Dangerously and Destination Worldview, Ponce, Puerto Rico, with travel journalist Neela Schwartzberg. Travel journalist Colleen Fleedler will discuss the Port of Farewells in Cove Island. So we have an interesting show for you here. So bear with us. And Mr. Evan Eggers is on the phone. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Roy. How are you?
Okay. I think I'm okay. I'm sort of fighting it here this morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. You sound all right.
Okay, great.
Hey, congratulations on your award, by the way. That's great.
No, thank you very much.
Well deserved.
Everybody works really hard on it, and we try to keep it away from flash and trash and try to give it some really in-depth journalism.
Well, we can also say that the key to making it sound easy on the radio is a lot of hard work in advance and behind the scenes. So listeners may not appreciate that, but I know how much work goes into making a show come off well. So
it's the research. The show part is the easiest. And with people like yourself, who always does a great job and comes off really well, you should have pursued this at one time in your life.
Hey, it's not too late. I'm not that old. What are you saying?
That's right. What's happening out there on the cruise scene?
Well, just this morning we found out that Queen Mary is having a propulsion problem with one of her four pods. Queen Mary had been setting sail from Port Everglades, Fort Lauderdale, for a 38-night South America trip. And she, shortly after setting sail, turned around and came back. The news reports are... Cunard doesn't know exactly what happened yet, but they're suspecting they may have actually hit a submerged object with the ship. So they said they were sailing out and felt a noise and a big shudder and just turned around and came right back. Obviously, there's no danger. Nothing is really amiss, other than the fact they want to find out what happened before they decide what to do next.
Exactly. I was down in St. Thomas, and the QE2 ran aground there. They got caught up on a sandbar, which was kind of embarrassing, I should have thought.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the captain of the ship never has a big smile on his face after one of these things happens, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Now, you're saying that the U.S. Maritime Administration shows a 4.5 increase... through 2005.
Yeah, that's right. This is the season when lots of cruise statistics are coming out. The U.S. Maritime Administration, they keep track of all the cruises that touch the U.S. or Canada. So in order to be included in their count, a cruise has to touch the U.S. or Canada. And they're showing a 4.5% increase in cruise sailings through the third quarter of 2005, versus the third quarter of 2004. And what was interesting, we all know, we've heard the statistics before from CLIA and others, that we know that the cruise industry is doing great and consistently growing. What was more interesting is that who the big winners were, and that was Norwegian was far and ahead, the biggest growth in these numbers, with 49 departures added year over year, which not surprisingly I think is driven by their Hawaii product, where they're the only game in town. They brought in the two new ships, and a third will be joining later on this year. And then Princess, which is not what I would have guessed necessarily, just, you know, if I had to come up with a name, Princess was the second biggest grower with 22 departures added during that same time period.
That's a big add, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that's a lot of sailings that are added, and it's, you know, some of that Princess, of course, is the West Coast cruises they've done a lot with. And, you know, it's funny, because Princess is one of those cruise lines where, even though they're owned by Carnival, as so many others are, but they don't do a ton of advertising anymore. They just, you know, it's a premium product. They grow consistently, but they don't have the splashy ads on TV all the time like Royal Caribbean does or like Carnival does. And as a result, you know, people, they may not be top of mind, but, you know, they're a great premium cruise line, and they're growing and doing well.
Now, Holland American class of ships, they're going to be named the signature class for delivery in 2008.
Yeah, that's right. So listeners who follow the cruise industry may recall we spoke in the past about Holland America's signature of excellence upgrades that are going in or have gone in on all of Holland America's existing ships. They covered a lot of stuff, everything from, you know, pillow top bedding to a culinary demonstration center, you know, just all kinds of stuff all over the ship. And now they've decided that the new class of ship itself will be named Signature Class in honor of all those upgrades. And these are the first new builds that Holland America will have announced since that program came out. And it'll be Holland America's largest ships yet. And the delivery of the first will be in 2008, as you mentioned. And Holland America has an option for second of these Signature Class vessels in 2010. And if they do take delivery on the second as well, that'll increase their overall capacity by 20%. And, and for people, you know, we occasionally get questions. Let's say that one of your listeners out there wants to start a cruise line. Who wouldn't want to start a cruise line, right, Roy? I mean, really.
Right.
Well, it seems like a really good gig, doesn't it?
Right.
If you wanted to go start a cruise line, how much do you need to go to your bank and withdraw to buy a ship? And if you wanted one of these new Holland America Signature Class ships, if you wanted to get that new ship smell, not buy used, $450 million each. Check your credit lines. If you want to start a cruise line, there you go.
I think you need a pretty good line of credit, because you never need one. You always need more than one.
Yeah, that's right. You've got Orient Lines with just one ship. It should be Orient Line, I suppose, but you know.
I see that Cruise West acquired Clipper Cruise Line.
Yeah, that's right. Cruise West.
Well, they acquired the coastal vessels.
They acquired the coaster vessels. That's right. They didn't acquire the whole cruise line. They acquired the coastal vessels, Yorktown Clipper and Nantucket Clipper. So Cruise West, which a lot of people think refers to the fact they do a lot of business in the West, in Alaska, when in fact it's actually named after a fellow who's the current president named Dick West, the family business, hence Cruise West. You know, they do a lot of really cool small ship stuff up in Alaska, is what they're best known for.
Yeah, I guess the Yorktown is, 138 passengers?
Yeah, the Yorktown and Nantucket Clipper are both small ships that have been on the east coast of the U.S., or remain on the east coast of the U.S. through 2006 under the new ownership of Cruise West. And then, in turn, the two remaining ships with Clipper Cruise Line, they've been bought by Intrav, which is one of the better-known super luxury travel companies. And the remaining two Clipper Cruise Line ships that went over to Intrav, they're doing like very upscale expedition type of travel around the world. So it's an interesting thing, and what I thought made this newsworthy is just an opportunity to mention to people that it's not all big boats out there.
That's,
you know, you have a Cruise West is a, you know, especially around Alaska, if you're the kind of person who doesn't, a big boat cruise doesn't sound good to you, the dressing up, the big meal, the casinos and all that, Clipper Cruise Line has these tiny expedition style vessels that creep, you know, right up against glaciers, that creep into little coves and bays where you can see wildlife right up close from the deck of the ship. It's just not possible with a larger vessel. So
yeah,
it's something worthwhile to look into.
It's terrific. And I don't know if we touched on this last week, that Silver Sea Cruises extended its Mediterranean season by 1 month, and they're going to call in Lebanon, Libya, and Syria.
That's right. You know, we're very happy to see that these places that they're very appealing for adventuresome travelers, people who like to really go places that are interesting, unusual, and experience other cultures. The cruise lines are going back to those places, and it's great, with Silver Sea leading the charge there.
Evan, we got to go, and once again, thanks. Good segment, and thanks for all the interesting news, and we hopefully will be talking to you next week.
Absolutely. Hope your voice holds out.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I'm working at it.
Bye, Roy.
Thanks, Evan. Bye for now. Evan Eggers, always great information, and we thank him for sharing that with us. While I'm trying to keep my voice intact, we're going to go to break.
Totally gone native. Totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks, all-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot, yeah, time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
I just did a whole intro, and our mic was down, and my voice was failing. But but basically what I said was that Orlando is really best known for its major theme parks and are constantly adding new attractions. However, Orlando is also known as a city of gardens and galleries, of the visual and performing arts, of history and heritage, and, of course, outdoor recreation and cultural treasures. And maybe we should start off with that.
Sure. I think that's often a subject that people are interested in hearing more about because, of course, our major theme parks are very popular here, Walt Disney World, Universal, Orlando, SeaWorld, and Discovery Cove. But sometimes people are interested, I think, in seeing some other parts of the destination as well. There are a few things that I would highlight. We have more than 95 attractions, and that's not just the major attractions, but that includes our middle-sized attractions, our outdoor activities, as you mentioned, our museums, our galleries, and things like that. So we do have some world-class facilities here in Orlando. I would say one of the highlights is the Charles Hosmer Morse Museum of American Art that's located in Winter Park, Florida, along Park Avenue. That museum houses the largest collection of the works of Lewis Comfort Tiffany. So people are often surprised to learn that you know, treasure is located here in Orlando. It's an amazing museum with, like I said, hundreds of pieces from the works of Lewis Comfort Tiffany. Beautiful, he's best known, I think, for his lamps and things like that, but you've also got window enclosures and some rare pieces of art that museum houses. So I think that's definitely a highlight in terms of culture here in Orlando. We also have some great outdoor activities as well. People may not realize that the headwaters of the Florida Everglades are here in Orlando. So some things like canoeing, kayaking, airboat rides, for example, are very, very popular. Boggy Creek Airboat Rides is one of our most popular venues. You can go out and take about an hour out onto Lake Toho, which is actually in Kissimmee, and see, gators and birds, all sorts of flora and fauna. So, that's a pretty exciting thing as well. And then I would say, thirdly, some of the more sort of interesting things that you can do here that people might not be aware of is hot air balloons, for example. We have a couple of organizations, companies here that do hot air balloon rides first thing in the morning. So near the Lake Buena Vista area, actually, so you get a bird's eye view of the major attractions, specifically Disney. There's a few companies that are in that area, so it's very nice to kind of see that first thing in the morning, along with champagne in hand, because they do tend to do the champagne edition when you're up in the airboat in the hot air balloons. So.
And of course, Wiki Wah.
Exactly. We can't forget that.
Yeah, I love that word, wiki-wah.
Wiki-wah.
Well, actually, as you well know, the meaning, wiki-wah is a creek, and the meaning is a spring of water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am aware of that, actually.
And I don't think that many people realize how many lakes and the number of parks in the area.
No. 300. We have 300 lakes in our region. So obviously those lakes lend themselves to, water skiing, boating activities, things of that nature. So, you don't necessarily, just because we're central and inland and we're not on the coast, there are plenty of activities that people can do here on waterways.
Now, of course, Winter Park, they call a city within a city.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting that Rollins College was founded in 1885, and it's the oldest recognized college in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Rollins College, actually.
Mm-hmm. Is it Rollins?
Yes, Rollins College is actually in the heart of Winter Park.
Right.
It's one of the most renowned schools in the Southeast. It's got an amazing business program. It's a liberal arts school. But Winter Park is actually just a quaint, wonderful little community. It's, became popular in the 1800s when the wealthy Northerners would come down and wanted, warm weather vacation havens. So they started building their million-dollar mansions along the chain of lakes, actually, that's in Winter Park.
And, of course, the Kraft Azalea Gardens.
The Kraft Azalea Gardens. Lou Gardens is actually another area, which is just outside of Winter Park. Some beautiful gardens, and just outside of Winter Park, too, you have the Cultural District, which is the Orlando Museum of Art, the Orlando Science Center, and the Minello Museum of American Art. So you've got kind of the cultural corridor, just inside and outside of Winter Park. So,
and I also thought that it was interesting, as the Museum of Art has the largest collection of works by Louis Tiffany.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the Morse Museum, which I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Yes, that's right on Park Avenue in Winter Park. So definitely something we're seeing.
Just quickly, if you will, what is happening with some of the theme parks? Anything new for 2006?
Well, you know the theme parks.
My feet know the theme parks.
Your feet probably know the theme parks. But, you know, the theme parks do a great job with constantly adding new things for people to see. Disney, of course, is at the forefront of that, always adding new attractions for people to visit. Probably their biggest news right now is the addition of Expedition Everest, which is 3 years in the making, and they're coining it the new runway train adventure that'll open late April, early May at Disney's Animal Kingdom.
How exciting.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting over at Disney. Universal, right now they're getting ready to celebrate Mardi Gras, which is an annual celebration.
Right.
It is probably the most popular part about it is there's a concert series that runs from February 11th through April 22nd and features such names as Hall & Oates, Kid Rock, Bonnie Raitt, George Thorogood, so, you know, some big names, big entertainment, so that's always exciting to see over at Universal. And then over at SeaWorld, which is sort of the big, we call them the big three, SeaWorld rounds that out, and they're actually getting ready to unveil their new killer whale show, the new Shamu show called Believe, that showcases several of their killer whales with choreography, a three-story set, original musical score, with, you know, LED screens. So if you've been to SeaWorld before and remember Shamu Stadium, this is where this new show is going to be, Believe, when they're in the process of renovating that right now to launch the show in April.
Well, so. Julie, thank you. Thank you for joining us. I know I didn't give you very much notice on this,
and
it was very informative. And we should do it again because we're thinking about possibly doing a Destination Florida segment. So we do, you'll be the first to know.
That's wonderful. I'd be happy to participate once again.
Thanks, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
Four Years of Living Dangerously is the subject of today's discussion by travel adventure author Antonio Graceffo. In this complex and multi-layered report, Antonio takes on his own personal odyssey, a journey that happens in a physical, emotional, and spiritual realm. Good morning, Antonio.
Good morning. How are you today?
We're terrific, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, for a kid from Brooklyn working the stock market, then leaving it all to go to Taiwan, with the ultimate goal of spending time in China on the cheap, it's a pretty gutsy decision.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, 9/11 was a real wake-up call. I mean, that was a pretty traumatic event, and it affected me.
And reading through your article, why don't you just share with our audience? You were at a brokerage house, and you were working the system like we all have. We're all in the ex-New Yorkers as well, and. So you just decided you were going to get away from it all. Why don't we start with your break from the stock market?
Sure. Well, basically, you know, I, like everybody else, I'd had dreams since I was a kid. You know, I always wanted to go to the Shaolin Temple. I used to watch the TV show Kung Fu with David Carradine. You know, and I studied martial arts my whole life. I always wanted to go to Shaolin Temple. I'd done my university studies, 4 years of university abroad. And I wanted to go abroad again, and there were just so many places I wanted to see, things I wanted to do, and I just realized, you know, if you put those things off forever, they're never going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, you suddenly got it all together, closed up everything, packed up your bags, and though your destination was China, you ended up in Taiwan.
That's right. The first step was Taiwan because I really wanted to go to China to Shaolin Temple, but I just thought, you know, going straight from Brooklyn to China would be like going from sea level to the top of Mount Everest. You know, I think you're going to die if you do that, so you have to acclimatize. So I went to Taiwan first, which was really good. I learned a lot of Chinese culture. I was speaking Mandarin fairly fluently by the time I got to China, which was a huge help. And Taiwan was a good transition. I call it China Light.
Now, is it called Mai Tai, like the drink?
Muay Thai.
Muay Thai, okay. And that's how you started. And you must have a knack for languages, because as I go through this, you were speaking a number of different languages in a relatively short period of time.
Well, I speak about 9 languages, but I was raised non-strictly trilingual. I speak Italian and Spanish,
okay.
Which I've spoken since I was a child.
Well, your parents are originally from Italy?
That's right. Yeah, my parents are from Italy. I grew up with Italian and Spanish. My grandmother also taught me. My first reading language was French, so it made a big difference. And by the time I got to Asia to learn Chinese and Khmer and Thai, it wasn't that difficult.
Right. Okay. So now you get over to you get to Taiwan, and at some point you stayed at a monastery where everybody kind of shared everything.
Right. That was in Thailand. Yeah.
It was in Thailand. Okay.
Right. That was a crazy story. I'd heard about this monk that was living on the border of Thailand and Myanmar, and yeah. He was doing drug interdiction work for the government. He was a warrior monk. He was teaching Muay Thai, which is the Thai kickboxing. He was teaching that to the young monks living at the monastery, and then they would go ride through the villages and talk to the kids about, you know, not using drugs, and they would fight with the drug dealers when they had to. And so I flew to Thailand to find that monk and to live with him and study with him.
His name was Kru Ba.
That's right, Kru Ba.
Right. And so you say in here that you shared everything, and you mentioned that you're out there doing some work and you come back and you're hungry, and you turned around and you asked them if you could have some of these fried cockroaches. Now, were they actually cockroaches or...
Yeah, they eat fried cockroaches, fried spiders, just all sorts of bugs, crickets. Crickets are really popular, grub worms, all sorts of things like that. When you're living in the monastery, the only food that you have is that the young monks go begging in the morning, and the hill tribe people give them food, and that's the only food we have. There's no money in the monastery to buy food, and we work on a farm, but all the work that we do on the farm is actually just to get feed for the horses. So all of our food came from begging, and protein was the one thing that you were lacking most. You know, it was very rare that they gave us meat, so when we had bugs or something, that was a real treat.
Right, and you couldn't, you weren't anywhere where you had a little pocket change and could hop down to a 7-Eleven.
No, a few times when we were riding out to the field, I'd convince them to stop and let me buy something, but then obviously I had to buy for everybody, which
right.
I didn't mind doing, but it was expensive.
How many people were in this monastery?
About 35.
So it's, and what was their background? How did they get into this?
They were mostly from hill tribe families in Thailand and Cambodia, Myanmar, all through Indochina. There are these tribes that originated in Tibet. And in Thailand, these tribes have migrated down. They're living in Thailand, and they are stateless people. They don't have Thai citizenship. They don't have Myanmar citizenship. In Myanmar, the government is actually trying to exterminate them, which forces them over the Thai border. The Thai government doesn't want them, and they're just caught in this horrible limbo. About 2,000 of them were killed in 1 year during the war on drugs.
Well, and so now here you are. You were learning Chinese in the language of Kung Fu and Buddhism, as you say, and your main ambition now still is to get to China, and you wanted to continue your training at the Shaolin Temple.
That's right.
And then you did a book about your experiences in Taiwan.
Right, right, right. The book about Taiwan was called Taiwan Days. That hasn't come out yet.
Okay.
The book about Shaolin Temple is out, and that's called The Monk from Brooklyn.
Okay. All right, so then your great leap forward was you made it to mainland China.
That's right. I made it to mainland China. I flew to Henan Province and went to... I just got in a taxi, and I said to him, I want to go to the Shaolin Temple. So he took me to Shaolin, and along the way we stopped and picked up his friend who knew a monk at the Shaolin, and we got there at night. the doors, everything was locked up. It was just like in the movies. It was this big medieval gate, you know, and we just saw a monk passing by. We told him what we wanted to do. He let us in. In the end, I paid a $200 bribe to a monk, and I slept there that night and the next night.
And so this was a start of a new relationship.
It was the start of a new relationship. That monk, after two nights, came to me and said, "Are you happy here?" I said, "Oh, I'm very happy." He said, "Okay, great. Do you want to stay for a year?" "Yeah, I'd love to stay for a year." He said, "Okay, give me $5,000.
Good Lord.
That's what I said. I said, look, the average income in China is like $60 a month. I'm not giving you, you know, a lifetime of earnings.
So in a sense, it was almost like being back in Wall Street.
It was exactly like that. I kept saying our philosophies are Eastern, but our payment methods are Western.
You know, I say, wait a minute. I thought I got away from all this. Now, what you know, are you bringing me back to that? I want to hang out with you guys.
Exactly. Yeah, I came here to learn about poverty, and I found out poverty just makes you a better businessman. But he introduced me to another monk that was willing to take me for $200 a month, which I thought was fair. He gave me room, board, training, everything for $200 a month.
Now, is this your training brother, Mao Tai?
Yeah, then, that was with the monk, and then the monk assigned me a training brother, and that was Miao Hai. And Miao Hai and I, there were two training brothers, Miao Hai and Miao Ping, and the three of us we trained together, we lived together, we shared our food together, everything for months that I was there.
Now, where did they get their money? They're asking you for $200 a month. Where are they getting their money from?
They only had to pay about $14 a month, I believe, for the Chinese students, and their parents would have been either corrupt officials, corrupt police or military, mm-hmm. or occasionally their parents were doctors who had enough money to pay the $12 a month.
Now, were they there to study, or were they going to spend their life there, or were they going to leave and go back into the real world?
The majority of them were just there to study Kung Fu. Very few of them actually become monks. Miao Ping wasn't actually a monk yet, but he lived as a monk, and he's constantly meditating and all this, and I suspect he will become a monk. But of, say, 65 students, there were only two or three who had become monks at that point.
Are you still in touch with them?
No, it's actually impossible to be in touch with them. They don't have email, and they can't read. Actually, a lot of them can't even read Chinese, and I can speak Chinese really well, but I can't write.
Right.
I can't even send them a letter.
Well, it's interesting because I had downloaded the Skype or Skypey, however you say it, onto my computer, and some gal came on one day from China, and I don't know if she was from Shanghai. I can't recall. Anyway, she was a technical type person and studying. And I thought, you know, how bizarre is this? Here you can sit here and just talk to somebody in China for free. But if you don't have access to a computer, of course, you can't do those things.
Yeah, that's it. Because now I keep in touch with all my friends in Cambodia, and it's very easy to use the internet, phone, and things like that. But for China, it's still very difficult. And what's really sad, though, is that if you Google Miao Hai's name, his name is actually on the internet, and there's articles about him, and I get mail for him. People ask me about Miao Hai. You know, how did he turn out? How's he doing this and that? And it's just really sad. He's actually, I guess, a minor celebrity in the West, and he doesn't know about it.
Poor fellow. Now, to go on, he said during the SARS epidemic, widespread paranoia swept through China and resulting in a distrust of foreigners. Well, because we're still going through that.
Right. The Chinese government was embarrassed by the fact that the World Health Organization said that SARS was caused by filth and spread by filth. They were embarrassed by that fact, so they told the Chinese people that SARS was actually caused by foreigners. And during national emergencies, the Ministry of Health becomes like a police organization. Any rules that they make have to be followed, otherwise it's a breach of national security. So they began these quarantine procedures, and one of the more common things was that they would just snatch foreigners up off the street and lock them in a hospital or in a hotel and charge them for it.
Well, just briefly, we have about another minute. Just tell us about the crossing of the desert.
I flew to Xinjiang, China, which is up in the Taklamakan Desert, up on the Pakistan border, and I bought a tricycle rickshaw for $36, and I filled it up with water and food, and I rode about 550 kilometers across the desert.
And then you bought an odd looking tricycle.
That's right. It's a tricycle rickshaw. It's like a rickshaw that you can pedal.
All right, and then you began to write. You started to write in earnest, and you decided, I guess, that maybe writing was where you were headed?
That's it, yeah. At that point, once I came back from Xinjiang, from the desert, then I started publishing, and the stories about Shaolin were bought up pretty quickly by magazines, and then the desert stories, and then that was it. I just didn't want to go back to a regular job anymore, and I went to Thailand and did all my adventures in Taiwan. Then I went back to Taiwan and did an adventure book at that point.
And I love the title of your first book, The Monk from Brooklyn.
It says it all.
That sure does say it all. Well, for those listening, all of this information and this article can be found on our website, ttrn.com, where you can read it more in depth. A very, very interesting story. And, Antonio, we thank you for sharing with this all with us, and we hope... I'm kind of losing my voice here. I'm fighting a cold. We hope to be talking to you again soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Hey, bye for now.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Totally gone native. Totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks, all-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
Well, we're back, and Pleasures of Ponzi.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico is our destination worldview topic today with our friend Neela Schwartzberg. Good morning, Neela.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fighting a little bit of a cold. You might hear it in my voice. I keep losing it from time to time, so I'm sort of fighting my way through it. But
I think you need to go to Puerto Rico and lay in the sun. Oh, you're in Florida. Never mind.
Well, but it was last couple of days, it's been a little bit chilly. I'd like to start off, Neela, if I will, because you start off this wonderful article with sitting at a table in the open-air La Terraza restaurant in Ponce Hilton Hotel. The sky is cloudless blue. The sun is shining. There is a soft breeze, and I'm having breakfast watching a blackbird raid the sugar.
Yes.
Only an incurable romantic can paint words like that, Neela.
It was so glorious. There's something so special about flying out of cold, snowy, icy weather and into paradise.
It's funny because I'm trying to... There was a well-known San Francisco poet who started out one of his poems with, "I was sitting at a table eating breakfast, and there was a fly sitting on my napkin, and I didn't want to wake him up," or something along those lines. So that was the feeling I got, and I was sold immediately. I went out and bought tickets to Ponce. So
you'll love it. Actually, you've been there, haven't you?
Well, I have, a long time ago. Yeah, we used to fly in there, and it's a great little place. And I guess it was officially founded in 1692. Interestingly enough, by the grandson of the famous Juan Ponce de Leon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got quite an illustrative history, and it's just a very, very charming city. It's as of course, obviously, it dates back 300 years, and it has beautiful historic buildings that have been restored. It's got lovely museums. It's got fabulous beaches, delightful places to stay. It's laid back and mellow with plenty to do, plenty to see, and fabulous day trips. And I just think it's one of the lesser-known gems in Puerto Rico.
Well, because it's always been overshadowed by San Juan, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, San Juan is a terrific place.
It is.
But Ponce is very special, and I'm happy to tell the world about that.
Well, let's tell the world a little bit more about it.
Okay. One of the, I guess it's called a must-see attraction, because you really must, and you can't miss it, is the fire station in
right.
The heart of Ponce. And I was in Ponce, and I was concerned that I'd miss this fabulous fire station because I didn't realize how impossible it is to miss it. It's this gargantuan, huge structure, painted literally red and black stripes, and it dominates the square along with the church, and you can't miss it. And it was all decorated for Christmas with twinkling lights. It was just straight out of a fable of some kind.
And originally, you say it was built in 1882.
Mm-hmm. Ponce had a large exposition. They wanted to highlight their agriculture, their progress, all their manufacturing products. And so they had this big festival exposition. And the building was built for that. And then later on, the next year after the exposition was over, it became the Ponce Fire Station. And it served as a fire station for about 100 years, over 100 years, until 1990, when it was reopened as a combination museum and tourist information center. And it's just a fabulous building. It's on the National Register of Historic Places.
And I think what's interesting is that you mentioned that the 25th of January in 1899, that they were told not to fight a fire that had broken out in some...
A munitions sack. I can munitions, only assume that they thought it was too dangerous. But I have no idea, and nor do the people of Ponce really understand. They just know that the firefighters were told not to fight the fire, and the city was in danger of being burned down. It's, largely wooden structures
exactly.
at that time.
Yeah.
And so the firefighters decided to kind of go against orders, and they fought the fire. They succeeded.
These were volunteer firemen.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. They weren't paid, but this was their city.
Of course.
So they saved the city, and the people loved them and considered them heroes, which they were. And so it put the government or the governing body, whatever, in an awkward position because they couldn't very well incarcerate these people for saving the city. So they kind of relented. And then 7 years later, in 1906, they... started a policy of building a house each year, because these were unpaid firefighters, and
right.
They would build a house each year and raffle it off to one of the firefighters to live in. And so that's
and they did that each year now for
each
some...
Each year. I don't know if they're still doing it, because there's about 60 homes. So if they were still doing it, there'd probably be about 100. So I don't know if they're still building homes and giving them to the firefighters or not. Probably not. They're probably paid professionals now,
well,
although I don't know.
The real estate market has probably changed a bit since 1906.
That's true, too.
Well, you could build a small house for in those days. And they were probably living most modestly before that, especially as a volunteer.
Yeah.
So that's quite unique.
And they're painted red and black stripes, so you
right.
can't miss them.
Right, which is the colors of the flag, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. The flag of Ponce.
Right. Tell us about the park.
Which
the park?
The
park of Bombas.
Oh, well, that's pretty much the fire station. And the plaza is a lovely plaza.
Because they have the Cathedral of Aledo Guadalupe there.
Yes, which was originally built in the 1830s. Then it was partially destroyed in fire, because fires were just rampant. And then it was rebuilt with the way it looks now in the 1930s. And it's a beautiful, beautiful cathedral.
Right.
And those two buildings dominate the, and of course my pronunciation is terrible, Plaza La Delicias.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Plaza of Delights. What
yeah.
could be nicer?
Yes, isn't that a charming name for a delightful plaza? So
exactly.
It's really lovely, and they have concerts, and there's fountains, and it's very charming.
So then you said you strolled east on Isabel Street, which is probably Isabella.
Yeah.
Admiring some of the other buildings and the Museum of History.
Yep, there's those two museums, the History of Ponce and the Museum of Puerto Rican Music. And you can just walk along and enjoy the beautiful, visit the museums, enjoy the beautiful buildings. You can go to the Tricentenary Park Plaza that was built for the 300th anniversary. They have the Bridge of Lions there, and they have commemorative plates and plaques for the famous native sons and daughters of Ponce. And then you can go outside of the downtown, and there's a, because what we have been talking about is really the historic heart of Ponce, but there's more modern Ponce
outside of downtown. Yeah.
And one of the highlights is the Ponce Museum of Art, and that was designed by the famous architect Edward Durell Stone, and it houses the art collection of Louis Ferré. I hope I'm pronouncing his name.
That was very good.
Oh, good. He's the former governor of Ponce, and the former governor, and he was born in Ponce. So that's why he chose to have his art collection shown and highlighted in Ponce. And it's probably the finest art museum in Puerto Rico.
And
it's
say,
really lovely.
And you say that each room in the School of Art is devoted to a different, like Flemish, Italian, and Spanish.
Yeah, they have, it's divided up that way. It's really interesting. So you can kind of get a feel for the different schools of art. And they have guided tours in English, and if you call and make arrangements in advance, you know, they'll set you up.
Right.
Or you can go and, you know, just show up and take your chances. But our docent, she was wonderful, just wonderful. It was not only the pieces themselves that she described, but the themes of art. And how it's linked to contemporary issues. In other words, things don't just happen in the past. History is actually a continuation. And there were also pieces that I had never seen before.
Yeah, I found that interesting, yeah.
Yeah, because they're originals, and they don't often travel. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to see these pieces, you have to go to Ponce.
Hmm.
So that's very cool.
Well, that's if nothing else, there's a good reason.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, tell us about the ceremonial center.
Well, that is one of the major archaeological destinations in the Caribbean, and it's one of only two ceremonial sites that have been found in Puerto Rico. And what makes it special is it goes back to 300 AD. This is really, really old. And it also is large in terms of the number of ceremonial plazas and ballparks. And the people who lived there, here again, I'm going to massacre the pronunciation, predate
the Taino Indians.
Say that again?
That's it.
Taino. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, the native population. I guess what people don't often realize, I certainly didn't realize it until I started traveling through the Caribbean, is that the people who live there now, the inhabitants, the natives, are not the original go back to the beginning folks.
Right.
Those folks were pretty much wiped out by the Spanish when they conquered the lands, and then they brought over the people from Africa to work and unfortunately enslaved them.
There
was a lot of course, intermarrying, but the original population kind of disappeared both as a result of the conquest and as a result of the disease. They had no immunity to...
Right. And the same thing happened in the Dominican Republic. The Taino Indians disappeared because of that as well.
Yeah.
I'll just briefly mention that you said there were some great day trips over to Coffin Island.
Yes. Coffin Island, unfortunately named Coffin Island.
Yeah, terrible name.
Caja de Muerto?
Yeah, Muerta.
Muerta?
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful day trip. What makes it so special, for me anyway, is that you can combine lolling around on the beach, bobbing up and down in the beautiful, beautiful turquoise water, with hike up to the top of the mountain where you get a lovely view. And there's an old lighthouse up there. And it's an interesting walk. It's a bit tricky in spots, but it's a lovely walk. And if you're adventurous, you can explore some of the caves that that are on the island. And it's just very nice. But what you have to remember is there's nothing on the island. It's there's a ranger outpost and some primitive toilets, and that's it. So whatever you want to eat or drink, you bring with you.
Neela, great story as usual.
Thank you.
And it's always a pleasure. We've got to run. But this article can be found either on our website, ttrn.com, or on Neela's, which is offbeattravel.com.
Thank you. Why always forget to plug my website?
Well, you know, I'm the naughty one. I should do that all the time for
yes,
you.
Yes, we should plug each other's websites.
Well, I see you do in some of your writing, so
yes.
we certainly appreciate that. And I look forward to chatting with you soon, and I hope my voice is going to last for the next 15 minutes.
Oh, me too.
Talk to you later.
Okay,
bye. For now. Neela Schwartzberg, we're going to go to break, and we'll be right back.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
Well, we're back, and before I lose my voice, we're going to be speaking with the travel journalist Colleen Fliedler about her article, Cove Island, The Port of Farewells. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Roy.
I hope you can hear me okay.
I can.
I've been fighting it, and my voice has been breaking up, but thank you for joining us today. And just say, Cove Island is located in a seaside town in County Cork, along the seaside coast, sometimes referred to as the Irish Riviera. Now, I haven't heard it referred to that as before, and I found that very interesting.
I hadn't either, and they are advertising that entire coast as the Irish Riviera, and that's because apparently they have warmer breezes there and sea currents that come in that are warmer, and it's the warmest part of Ireland, and certainly warmer than the rest of Great Britain. So that is, I guess there are a lot of really nice hotels and yachting activities and plenty to do if you go there.
Well, your article is really super, and it takes us back to some very, very interesting things. Why don't you just take us on a mental journey, if you will?
All right. Well, I went to Cove as a result of my interest in the Titanic and the Lusitania, and I had read that they both had this port in common in Southeast Ireland.
How fascinating is that?
Yeah, I know. So when I went there with a girlfriend, I said I have to do that and maybe bypass some of the more common touristy areas. And it's not as touristy as a lot of Ireland, and I found that delightful. And there's a lot of history there, and I'm a former historian, so that was a place that just called to me.
Now, although it's spelled C-O-B-H, you pronounce it Cove?
Yes, with a V sound. I understand in Gaelic that they don't have the letter V, but it is pronounced like we would pronounce Cove.
Cove, yeah.
And
okay.
It means something like safe harbor, about what it would mean for us. And at one point it was actually called Queensland, and it gets a little, or actually Queenstown.
Right.
It gets a little confusing, but in fact when Titanic and Lusitania both sank, it was referred to as Queenstown. And that was just for a couple of decades in honor of Queen Victoria. So if you're looking for it on a map, though, do look for C-O-B-H.
Well, okay, yes. Okay. I did look it up on the web, and I did I did find it, and that's one of the spots where I saw the Irish Riviera, and I thought, gee, everybody's getting onto this Riviera thing. And I never thought of Ireland although I've spent a lot of time in Ireland, and I've been to. Everybody's been to County Cork for those reasons where you lose change out of your pockets by trying to kiss a stone somewhere.
Right. So we bypassed that and went on to Cove.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Right.
Now you say that it was the port where about 2.5 million Irish left their homeland on ships bound for the United States and Canada between 1845 and 1960.
Right.
And then, of course, you mentioned the great sea disasters, the Titanic, and also the Lusitania. Let's just, if we can, you mentioned, if I may quote a little, I stood on the dock where the immigrants boarded the waiting ships those many years ago, and I gazed up the Cove steep, winding streets, a scene which had changed little over 100 years. Take us on from there.
Well, I think I am Irish, part Irish, and I did have family that actually left from there.
Could have fooled me with a name like Colleen.
Right, it was Colleen Adair was my maiden name.
Right.
And it gave me a very kind of an interesting feeling, knowing that this was the last time most of those people saw Ireland, and looking up and seeing the exact same thing that they would have seen all those years ago, as I say in the article. And they had to leave because of the potato famine, and it was either stay in Ireland and face certain deaths because there wasn't enough food, or try something else in another country. And that's why, actually, there was a lot more than 2.5 million who left Ireland during that time, but the majority of them left through Cove and came via New York, and then some of them went up into Canada. But most people that have Irish relatives that emigrated over and came over through Ellis Island especially could trace their families back to that particular port.
I think it was particularly interesting how you pointed out that most would never see Ireland again, and thus for decades the city became synonymous with farewells.
Right. It was also called the City of Sighs by a lot of the people, and it's kind of a mixed emotion that you have there, because it is such a wonderful place, and the people are so charming, but there is this underlying history of people leaving from there,
right,
or are the bodies being brought to shore from the Lusitania, and I mean, it's something that obviously the people don't dwell upon. They do have displays and things like that, but nonetheless, that's their heritage.
And
fascinating one.
And you go on, of course, to point out that their most famous immigrant was Annie Moore.
Right. She was only 15, and I was curious about her after seeing the statue of Annie and her two little brothers, and why her parents would have left them behind. And I actually bought a book online about her. She stayed with an aunt and uncle, and when the parents had enough money, they sent for the children. So they made the sea journey by themselves, these little children. And she was one of 700 immigrants off of a ship. She was the very first immigrant to be processed at Ellis Island. So they put those dual statues up of Annie, and she represents all Irish immigrants.
And they have it at both ends.
Yes, right.
Now, then on April 1912 is when the Titanic arrived.
Right. And again, it was a very special time because of that ship. It would be like now the biggest ship in the world being launched, and there were a lot of Americans in Ireland and British that came down and vacationed, and they said, well, we might as well vacation and catch that big, beautiful new ship and take her back to New York, and so they came into Cove and stayed there and vacationed in Ireland and so forth, and then boarded the Titanic there, and that was the last port of call for Titanic before she sank. So a lot of the people that boarded in Cove were victims of that sinking.
And you go on to say that the interview with Captain Smith and the other principal officers, I'm losing my voice here, were the last photographs taken of the Titanic?
Right, by the press that came out, and they did their news stories and so forth. And so we have the pictures that you see in books or even in the movie Titanic that they recreated. A lot of those were taken from the Irish reporters that came out to do the interviews, and some of the British that came down as well, because, as I said, that was the last port of call.
And then it was nearly a week later till word reached Cove about the Titanic sinking.
Yeah, apparently so, and I was trying to figure out how all that would have come about, but the people who put family on there swarmed back into town, and everyone just waited and waited, and then the news did come, I imagine, by telephone in those days, and they had these massive kind of memorials and so forth, knowing that their families had died, and there was nothing more they could do. It was really quite a sad time.
And almost exactly 3 years later, in May 1915, 1,100 people perished on the Lusitania.
Isn't that something? Yeah. And I saw pictures, and you will too when you visit the Cove Heritage Center. They do have pictures, and it's, again, quite sad. There were a lot of mothers with babies and that kind of thing that froze in the water. It was deep water offshore, and it is an amazing story about how people actually saw this happening.
You know, that was incredible here. It happened right before their eyes.
Absolutely. And I did go up. There is another memorial at the Old Head of Kinsale, which is about a half-hour drive from downtown Cove, and there's an old lighthouse there, and that's part of the shipping lanes, and they would come in from America, the ships, and take that route and then go into Cove. So they were skirting the coast. The captain in that case was held accountable because there had been warnings and sightings of German U-boats, their submarines, and they were at war, and the Germans had even put an ad in a New York newspaper warning passengers not to take that boat because they were going to sink anything with munitions. And, of course, Lusitania carried food and munitions and everything else. So it really wasn't a huge surprise, but it did. The sinking of that boat did bring the United States into World War I.
And in a matter of 18 minutes, the Lusitania was gone.
Yep, start to finish. Two big explosions, and down she went, and not enough time to get the lifeboats in the water, and so those people died.
So then the next thing that happened, of course, is that the locals went out in every available boat that they could find to try, in the effort to rescue the survivors.
Right, right. And they did. They rescued 700-plus, thankfully. But it still, which is hard to understand, it still took too long to get to most of them. And because I think our bodies can only stand cold water for so long, especially the vulnerable ones, like the children and so forth, most of them died.
From hypothermia. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Well, now, the ones that were taken back, of course, the bodies were dealt with as one would normally, but that people actually, because there were so many, they took them into their homes.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too, and I think that it's been too many years now, but I always wanted to go over and try to interview people that remember bringing people into their homes as children and so forth. But,
right.
Yeah, they had to bring them in. There was nothing else to do with them. They were wandering the streets. There's a story of a young girl whose family died, and she survived, a teenage girl, and she was, of course, in shock, and she wandered the streets, and finally a family took her in until they could figure out what to do with her and they get her back to some kind of relative. But the stories are just amazing that came out of that that accident.
And of course, there are massive communal graves that were dug at the old church cemetery.
Right. And it's very moving to go see those and know that there were so many families that perished together that there was no one to come over and claim the bodies. So they had to, you see the pictures of them, it's a big, big, long area, and they would put the caskets, these very bare bones kind of slapped together, caskets together, and put them in there, just line them up, and then put the dirt on top.
Now, you stayed at the Commodore.
I stayed at the Commodore.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I hadn't realized at the time that that would have been first class for a lot of the people that might have taken Titanic, the first class passengers. But I really enjoyed it there. It's even disregarding that, you have the beautiful views and so forth, but it is a very old hotel, lots of history, a great pub, good food, and furnished in period style. So it was quite interesting to stay in that room that the some of those people that would have boarded those ships stayed in.
And, of course, the feeling of just looking out there is, and standing in that space, which, in fact, as you say, people did stay in there.
They did, indeed. And as I say in the article, too, there were too many that had been injured in Lusitania to take them out of town, and they could only accommodate a small number in the hotels. So they did line up beds in these rooms and in all the hotels and in the homes and so forth, and they did what they could do to help people. It was really a community effort. So the people of Cove really should be and have been commended for their efforts to help with those tragedies.
And today there are memorials to the victims of Lusitania.
Yes, there are. A couple of them, I believe. Yeah. And then, of course, the cemetery. And, you know, if you do indeed go, do go by the cemetery, and it's a very moving experience.
Now, you can get there, what you say, you can get there by air because it's located 20 minutes from Cork International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And, 13 minutes by car from
right.
Cork City.
Right.
And then there's also train service.
It's not that hard to get there. It's amazing, and yet people don't seem to know about it.
It's amazing is right.
But it's not on most itineraries, as I say, and when you see the 10-day in Ireland itineraries laid out by tour operators, they don't bother to go there because it is off the main highway, and it does take a little extra time, but certainly worth the effort.
And your recommendations of where to stay?
Well, I enjoyed the Commodore immensely, but they continue to put newer hotels up and renovate older ones, and there are lots and lots of B&Bs. We did pop into the Highland B&B, which is very nearby, and the people there are just delightful. And you can also go online and rent houses and cottages and stay on farms. So there are a lot of accommodations that are unusual if you don't want the hotel experience. The Ritz hasn't come there, and the Holiday Inn is not there. It's mostly the older, typical Irish hotels that you'll find in this town.
And, of course, the one thing that everyone always asks, the food.
Well, we didn't have any problems with it. We ate a lot at the Commodore. We ate in some of the pubs, we did have pizza there, so, you know, it was just fine. It was fine. And Jacob's Ladder is quite good. It's won a lot of awards, and, you know, I would recommend Jacob's Ladder, a little on the more expensive side, of course, than some of the other places, but there you go.
Colleen, it's a great article, and very well written.
Thank you.
It's up on our site, and let's do this again.
Thank you so much, Roy, and I do hope you feel better.
I managed to get through this hour, so I'm sure I'm on my way to recovery. I was just afraid I was going to lose my voice in the middle of it all.
Right. You did fine.
All the best to you, Colleen, and we look forward to another segment one of these fine days, hopefully very soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye now.
Well, that was a very interesting article from Colleen, and if you go to our website at www.ttrn.com, you will find it there, and you can read it more in depth. Now, you can also check our upcoming program schedule by going to ttrn.com for the latest information, and next week we'll have Evan Agus with his cruise news again. Suzanne Wright's going to be with us on bungalows and boats in Tahiti. Stephanie Moreland is going to do Sacred Assisi, and the one and only Johnny Jett will be with us. So until next Wednesday, this is Roy Lowy saying goodbye for now and happy travels, and hopefully I'll be in a little bit better voice next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends on the Travel Talk Radio Network.
Visit our website at ttrn.com for complete show archives and interviews with guests like Chris Elliott, Peter Greenberg, Bob Fisher, Johnny Jett, and many other great travel professionals. Don't forget to tune in live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern for more Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends.